Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast in the New Books Network. My name is Derek Litvak, and I'll be your host. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Justin Gomer about his book, White Balance, How Hollywood Shaped Colorblind Ideology and Undermined Civil Rights, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2020. Dr. Gomer is an assistant professor of American Studies at California State University, Long Beach. White Balance explores the connection between politics and film from the 1970s to the 1990s. Dr. Gomer illustrates the myriad of ways that Hollywood relied on and helped solidify an emerging ideology of colorblindness in the wake of the civil rights movement. From films like Dirty Harry to Rocky, Dr. Gomer is able to show just how much issues of race, class, and bipartisan agreement over what to do with race in the new nation informed Hollywood, and how Hollywood was able to inform the public about these issues. Dr. Gomer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
So I guess to get things started, can you tell our listeners how you became interested in this topic and why you decided to study it?
Yeah, so I think my research interests have always centered around questions of race and popular culture. And, you know, as I was pursuing specific interests within that larger framework, I just became really interested in the relationship between Hollywood and how we think about race. You know, sort of from a cultural study standpoint, right? You start with the basic premise that popular culture doesn't just reflect the way that we think about the world; it actively shapes it. You know, there's a great Bertolt Brecht quote that says, "You know, culture isn't a mirror to hold up to society; it's a hammer with which to shape it." And I'm you know, sure, getting that quote slightly wrong, but that's sort of the gist. And so, you know, so I kind of start from a real belief in that sort of premise, and then as I just sort of worked through it, just became interested in questions of colorblindness, and felt like Hollywood was really an important site that ideology took shape, and that just sort of started me down the road of asking a lot of questions about the relationship to Hollywood and colorblindness. And this book is sort of what came of all of that.
And early on, you point out to readers the difference between what you call a colorblind rhetoric and an ideology of colorblindness. And as you point out, these are very different things, and it's very important in terms of how things change over time in the latter half of the 20th century. And so can you explain to our listeners what the difference between colorblind rhetoric and an ideology of colorblindness is?
Yeah, so colorblind rhetoric just refers to this idea of sort of a post-racial society, if you will, a society in which, you know, to paraphrase you know, Martin Luther King's most cited line, you know, a society in which people are judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, right? And so colorblind rhetoric was held up at times during the civil rights movement as this sort of goal, right? As a dream, if you will. The ideology of colorblindness, on the other hand, uses colorblind rhetoric to undermine civil rights and to actually inhibit larger struggles towards racial progress. And that's been the case since the civil rights movement. So I think when we're thinking about colorblindness, right, we have to be very careful about what we're talking about, right? Are we thinking about colorblindness as sort of a goal to hold up to our society, one of in which, you know, racial equality is something that we've achieved? Or are we talking about colorblindness as sort of an ideological strategy to challenge and often eliminate, if we're looking at the history of the decades since the civil rights movement, to actually eliminate some of the very victories of the civil rights movement? And so I think it's always important to keep those two things separate in our mind, that there is the rhetoric of colorblindness again, and then the actual ideology, which the work of the ideology has actually proven to undermine civil rights.
And I think one thing that I found really interesting about your discussion of that was how you pointed out just the title of your work coming around, you know, this issues of colorblind rhetoric and an ideology of colorblindness, because it's called white balance. And you point out that that has a sort of two-layer meaning, about one being sort of, you know, in photography and cinematography, it's used to sort of set the rest of the color automatically. And then, as you say, it is used in a sort of another sense to sort of foreground and center whiteness in this project, from in sort of in Hollywood and then in society itself.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, a lot, you know, what I'm trying to signal in the title is that what ultimately the results of the ideology of colorblindness have been to this point. And I think it's sort of another question whether or not we are still living in what we might call the age of colorblindness. But certainly the net result of the ideology of colorblindness in the decades after the civil rights movement was to kind of recenter and reinforce white supremacy around a discourse that was race neutral.
I know, as someone myself, I do sort of photography on the side. I sort of appreciated sort of dual meaning there, and I didn't catch it when I first saw the title to begin with. And so it was a nice little sleight of hand on your part, in my opinion.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I wish I could take all the credit for that, but honestly, that was my editor's title, and it was, you know, it's one of the many reasons why I had a wonderful editor, Brandon Proya at UNC Press. But yeah, my title for the book was rejected very quickly by the editorial board at UNC, and I think for good reason. And I'm very happy with what came of the title. And it was one of those things that as soon as it came up as an idea, you know, it quickly made sense of why that title would speak much better to kind of the philosophical and sort of theoretical interventions of the project.
Yes, I always find us scholars are really good about explaining things, not exactly as good at titling things.
That's exactly right. That's in some ways that was the hardest, you know, giving titles to individual sections and chapters was some of the hardest work of the entire project.
And so delving into the work, one of the things that you first look at is the emergence of what you call New Hollywood, or what was called New Hollywood, and how that is sort of, you know, kickstarting or sort of getting on the bandwagon of the emerging ideology of colorblindness. So can you explain to us what's going on during that time period?
Yeah. So New Hollywood is sort of this era in the history of Hollywood that comes about roughly alongside of the civil rights movement and the years after the civil rights movement. So if you think about the ideology of colorblindness sort of emerging in the aftermath of the civil rights movement, New Hollywood emerges at roughly the same time. And to understand New Hollywood, you have to just know a little bit about the classical Hollywood studio system, which was in Hollywood the business model that more or less informed movie making from, you know, around the 1920s through the 1950s. It was a business model founded or sort of informed by this idea of vertical integration, where studios controlled the production, distribution, and exhibition of all of their films. And it was a model that made Hollywood incredibly popular, right? So that by the 1930s, you have, you know, Americans going to roughly one movie per week. What happens, though, is for a couple of reasons, that business model and the popularity of Hollywood declined significantly over the course of the 1950s and into the 1960s. Some of that was Supreme Court decisions that ruled that the vertical integration business model violated antitrust law. And the other piece of that is the rise of television, right? That over the course of the 1950s, basically Americans become TV owners and start watching a lot more television and movies in their house and start going to movie theaters less and less. So by the time you get into the 1960s, Hollywood's in really bad shape. And so what it had to do was basically reorient itself and find a new path forward. And what emerged out of that was New Hollywood. And so some of the characteristics of New Hollywood then is sort of a different sort of business model. But what you also get with New Hollywood is the elimination of the production code, right? That that regulated content in Hollywood during the classical era. The production code is then replaced by the modern rating system that we have, right? So if you think about the production code, basically what that did is it required all movies to more or less be PG rated if we think about them in terms of contemporary ratings. New Hollywood then creates the modern rating system. And so you're able to explore a much wider range of content. You also have, because of the very poor economic performance of Hollywood in the 1960s, you also are dealing with significant budget restraints. So the importance of New Hollywood and understanding colorblindness then deals with this idea of Hollywood being in sort of a desperate situation, but having the opportunity to explore content that it had previously been unable to explore during the classical era. And so that desperation, I argue, created more opportunities for different sorts of stories, different sorts of filmmakers to find their way onto Hollywood movie screens. And very early, what happens is that in these sort of years, in the decade or so after the civil rights movement, you start to have these early themes that we might sort of connect to colorblindness or an emerging colorblind ideology really play out and find their way onto Hollywood movie screens and more than anything else, find popularity among movie audiences.
And one of the things that you point out as well is that during this sort of initial period, New Hollywood doesn't have the sort of monopoly that we think about today, where, you know, if there's a new film coming out, we automatically sort of assume it's coming from Hollywood studios. And so one of the things that you point out is that other filmmakers and other sort of filmmaking companies are able to also participate in this emerging ideology. And one of the films that you look at is Claudine. And so can you explain to our listeners how that works into this, and maybe just a brief summary of what Claudine is for people who might not be familiar with it?
Yeah, so Claudine is an independent film made in the early 1970s by a company called Third World Cinema. And what Third World Cinema was it was a collection of artists, film producers, filmmakers, actors, and so forth that got together to try to make movies that offered representations of communities of color and communities that had been marginalized historically on Hollywood movie screens, African Americans in particular, to make different sorts of movies that showed different, more humane representations of African Americans that really centered Black life and Black experiences. And so the first film that TWC makes is Claudine. The basic plot of Claudine, it stars Diane Carroll and James Earl Jones, two sort of iconic Black actors. And Claudine deals with the title character, who plays a single mother on welfare in Harlem. And the movie centers around the difficulties of her providing for her family while also complying with very punitive welfare requirements, right? So the film explores why, in order for her to receive welfare benefits, there's all sorts of rules about whether or not she can date, who she can date, whether or not the person she dates can buy her anything like a toaster, whether or not the person she falls in love with, who is James Earl Jones, is allowed to live in her house, and whether or not any income she earns through work sort of invalidates her qualifications for welfare benefits. And so what you have in Claudine ultimately is sort of a look at Black urban life in the 1970s that explores how, in fact, welfare really undermined the sort of structures and fabric of Black families rather than assisted in any sort of way.
And for me, I found it really interesting, your sort of discussion of this film, mostly like on a two-part one, just, you know, your general sort of thesis going on about colorblindness and how this film sort of represents it and is, you know, as you said, sort of pushing back on certain images of Black and other marginalized people in Hollywood. And then for myself, because I hadn't watched this film, it was interesting to see how in the 1970s people were discussing this. And as someone who grew up with a parent on welfare, there were so many of these things that you were talking about that I was like, oh, well, this is still very much there, if so much slightly different in, you know, sort of the 90s and early 2000s that I was growing up in.
Yeah, and it's a really wonderful film. And I think the reason why I think it's so important as a lens to examine the emergence of colorblindness, because colorblindness as a coherent ideology really doesn't take shape and really cohere until the middle of the 1970s. So when you have a film like Claudine, you're a few years away from that. And I think why Claudine is therefore so important is that what you see is colorblindness as an emerging ideology that is yet to kind of find its final shape. And so one of the things that I think is so fascinating about Claudine is that it's very, very clearly a quote unquote Black film. Right, you're dealing with Harlem, this iconic Black neighborhood. You're dealing with a family that's on welfare, which in terms of sort of public racial discourse in the aftermath of the Moynihan Report, welfare gets racialized very explicitly as this benefit that is exploited by Black women, and that's sort of this racialized myth of welfare that emerges around the same time. There's all sorts of explicit discussions. In the movie itself about issues of racism impacting Black communities. When the film was marketed, when it was sold, there was all sorts of interviews done and press materials released that tried to position colorblindness as a quote unquote colorblind film. So you see language used like, this is a film for all families. This is a film that all Americans can relate to. And so there's this disconnect where on the one hand, you have a film that speaks very specifically to issues related to race and urban poverty that were impacting African Americans in particular. And yet there's also this need for the filmmakers. You can sort of see this desire to appeal in a more kind of race neutral or colorblind fashion. And so I think what that shows is that there's this emerging idea of colorblindness. Colorblindness is starting to kind of take a hold of sort of popular discourse around race. But yet you have a movie that's very explicitly sort of racialized. And then the other thing about Claudine that's absolutely worth mentioning is that the original script for Claudine was about a white woman on welfare whose husband had died of cancer. And so over the course of turning this initial idea into the film that would become Claudine, you change the racial identity of the family, and therefore that changes very much how the film is read and sort of the politics of the film itself. So to argue, right, that Claudine was in any way sort of a colorblind film or that race wasn't a central feature, both in sort of how the script was conceived, how the movie was shot, and so on and so forth, is one that you couldn't make. And yet, nonetheless, the way it was marketed was in this sort of colorblind fashion. And so, you know, that's some of the contradiction that you see around colorblindness in the early 1970s. It's not tied to a specific sort of political project. It's very much in bits and pieces, and you see it throughout public and political discourse.
And as you said earlier and just now, you know, colorblindness is not sort of coherent yet at this time period in the early 1970s, but by the mid to late 1970s, it does become coherent. And so what changes during that time period that you're able to see? And how do we see this playing out in film?
Yeah, so what coheres the ideology of colorblindness is widespread white opposition to two civil rights issues, school integration and affirmative action. And so by the time you get to the middle of the 1970s, what had happened is that white folks come to vehemently oppose, on the whole, school integration through things like busing. So you can think of the Boston busing riots, for example, as a primary example of this. and the other issue being affirmative action. So by the time you're to 1974, 1975, 1976, school integration and affirmative action had become very unpopular among white folks. And the other piece of this, though, is that opposing civil rights movements, right? So, or opposing civil rights programs. So affirmative action and school integration were victories of the civil rights movement and sort of programs initiated during the civil rights era. And so because of that, right, because we're a decade after civil rights, it's not seen as acceptable to just say, I oppose school integration because I don't think African-American kids should be able to attend my neighborhood schools. Or I oppose affirmative action because I don't think Black job candidates should be allowed to work in my union, for example. And so what happens is that opposition to these civil rights programs had to take shape in a way that they did not violate the sort of terms of post-civil rights racial discourse. And so what you begin to see is as in order for opposition to these programs to gain traction, they began to frame themselves or support or opponents of these civil rights programs began to frame their opposition increasingly through the rhetoric of colorblindness. So what you have, for example, is saying, I don't know, I support civil rights. I believe in racial equality. And that is why I oppose affirmative action, because affirmative action makes explicit mention of race. And I believe in the idea of a colorblind society. And therefore, that is why I oppose affirmative action. Or I believe in a colorblind society, and that therefore that is why I oppose race-conscious school assignments, right? And so, what you begin to see is that some of the rhetoric of the civil rights movement, specifically the colorblind rhetoric of the civil rights movement, and it's important to point out here, right, that folks are not ever borrowing pieces of Martin Luther King's speeches from other speeches he gave, right? There's nobody citing the letter from Birmingham jail, for example. The only thing you see cited is a single line from his I Have a Dream speech. But that becomes an effective way to both build white opposition to civil rights and also a way to frame civil rights opposition as not being opposed to civil rights, but actually to be in support of civil rights. And in this era is also where you see the emergence of this idea or this phrase, reverse discrimination, right? So you begin to see public discourse that's arguing that, in fact, civil rights programs had gone too far in trying to integrate American schools, too far in trying to integrate American universities and things like police unions and fire unions, fire department unions, that what you had begun to do was to discriminate against white folks, right? And that's sort of the rhetoric of reverse discrimination emerges for that reason. And the way in which Hollywood picks up on that, I think, is, you know, the first Rocky film is really important in this regard. And I argue in the book that Hollywood is the first that Rocky Balboa is the first hero of the ideology of colorblindness in Hollywood. Because in the first Rocky film, you have what is very obviously and undeniably this explicit struggle or showdown between a working class white fighter and a wealthy Black fighter. And throughout the film, you see all of this contrast in regarding the sort of hard work and determination of Rocky Balboa contrasted with the sort of opportunism and the lack of training of Apollo Creed. And there's all sorts of iconography around America and American patriotism that gets assigned to Apollo Creed that does not get assigned to Rocky Balboa. And so the film itself visually sets up all of these things that show that that this is a showdown between a Black fighter and a white fighter. This is a showdown between, in many ways, an undeserving Black fighter who can lay claim to the nation, squaring off against a deserving white fighter, a hardworking Rocky Balboa that embodies everything we imagine as sort of ingredients of the American dream. And yet he is somebody left with no opportunity. You know, they end up fighting on an American flag ring. And nevertheless, the film never makes any explicit reference to race, right? Apollo Creed's never called a racial slur. His racial identity is never even acknowledged, but you see it. And that, I think, is ultimately why Hollywood is so important in shaping colorblind ideology in the decades after the civil rights movement, is that as race-conscious language is removed or expelled from public discourse around race and civil rights, Hollywood becomes a site, because it is a medium of visual culture, it becomes a place where you can see race and you can have sort of racial dramas without actually acknowledging race in discourse or in language. And colorblindness is very much about the language of race. And so to have this medium where you can see race without acknowledging it verbally becomes fundamental towards to shaping colorblind ideology.
Yeah, and I think that's so interesting, especially, you know, as you were just saying, and as you say in the book, you know, Rocky is sort of saturated with racial imagery and sort of symbolism. And yet, as you just said, and you say in the book, there's no mention of race sort of explicitly or even sort of implicitly. Yet it's there. It's definitely, you can't miss it. And it's sort of the way you delve into how, you know, Hollywood is making this, how the audience is going to receive this, and how the audience sort of wants their own beliefs to be reaffirmed during this time period.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think really the way that Rocky shapes who is our hero, who is our villain in that first film really centers around the question of who is an American and who is not. You know, Rocky Balboa's fight moniker is he's the Italian Stallion. He's not the Italian-American Stallion. Apollo Creed, on the other hand, enters that final fight at first dressed as George Washington. He then changes into a costume of Uncle Sam. He then fights with American flag boxing trunks. They fight on an American flag ring. And so there's all of this imagery assigned to Apollo Creed, that Apollo Creed is the American. But for him, these symbols of patriotism, right, they're just for show. They're just for ways to sort of build his brand and his wealth. And leading up to that fight, all of the scenes with Apollo Creed, his interest in the fight are solely around the ability for him to profit off of and make money off of this fight. Rocky Balboa, on the other hand, believes in sort of the purity and sort of sanctity of the sport of boxing. I mean, the movie starts with an image of, with sort of this mural of Jesus above a boxing ring, right? So the film sets up that boxing is this sort of sacred meritocratic space where two people fight and the better man wins. And yet what the film sets up is that Rocky embodies all of the characteristics of what we imagine are necessary in pursuit of the American dream. He's modest. He's hardworking. He just wants a shot at a better life. And yet he can't find that anywhere, right? He's trapped sort of in poverty. No matter how hard he works, he cannot get a chance. He cannot sort of find any traction in sort of upward mobility or advancing his boxing career. And that's contrasted with what we see as this black fighter that's become the heavyweight champion, that's acquired all of this wealth and prestige and celebrity, who is undeserving of that, right? And so in that way, it speaks directly to sort of the rhetoric of something like affirmative action. You know, you never see Apollo Creed train for the fight. He never once hits a punching bag or a speed bag. You never see him lift a weight or drink raw eggs. But Rocky does all of that, right? So it's, you see this direct contrast between who is deserving and who is undeserving, for whom is the interest or is the idea of America and the American dream something they truly believe in, versus for whom the American dream is just something to enrich your own personal wealth. And there's even a scene in that film that is explicitly sort of an affirmative action metaphor. Rocky at one point loses his locker in his boxing gym to a less experienced black fighter. Right. So if that isn't an explicit sort of engagement with affirmative act, the, you know, sort of anti-affirmative action discourse, right? This idea that less qualified, less experienced black candidates were being granted jobs and sort of positions at universities, that should have been given to more qualified white candidates is played out explicitly in that scene. And so you see very much throughout that film that metaphors and sort of the anti-affirmative action discourse is throughout that film. It shapes who is our hero, who is our villain. And it's done in a way, right, through this lens of who is the American, who is not, to leave you with this idea that America has prioritized and has turned the country over to undeserving African Americans, and in doing so has left behind the deserving, hardworking white working class, right? So it has this very explicit, if you're watching the film, backlash politics, very sort of explicit racialized politics, but it never mentions that in the dialogue of the film.
And going off even further on Rocky, you use Rocky III to illustrate how not only the ideology of colorblindness becomes more powerful over time, but you also tie it to Reagan's war on drugs and how, you know, again, there's this sort of, you know, sort of saturation of race and race images and symbolism, but again, sort of never explicitly tackled or explicitly mentioned. And so how do you tie Rocky III to the war on drugs and sort of, again, this sort of American history going further on and colorblindness becoming more coherent and sort of concrete?
Yeah. So if the emergence of colorblindness as a coherent ideology in the 1970s really takes shape around opposition to school integration and affirmative action, right? And you sort of see it in this kind of populist sense on the ground in sort of battles around affirmative action programs and school integration orders. The election of Ronald Reagan brings colorblind ideology to the White House, right? Ronald Reagan ran a campaign in 1980 that explicitly stated that he would sort of eliminate affirmative action and eliminate busing programs or busing orders. And so he really runs on this anti-civil rights platform that took shape in the 1970s around colorblindness. And as, you know, many other scholars have documented already, that what Reagan also really does is he uses the law and order politics developed with under sort of the Nixon administration and in Richard Nixon's presidential campaigns. And he really ramps those up, right? And so that you see in the early years of the Reagan presidency, the massive increase in the amount of dollars allocated to policing. You also see things like really ratcheting up mandatory sentences for drug possession. And you really see the shift in the way in which Reagan sort of shapes his policies on law and order, shifting into this idea of the war on drugs, right? Where the strategy of the Reagan administration, at least sort of in what it said, was that the way to eradicate crime was, and the way to eradicate sort of illegal drug use was to wage this effect, you know, this really aggressive policing campaign on particular communities. And what, you know, all of these other scholars of the war on drugs, Michelle Alexander and many others, have really documented is that for Reagan to do that, what he really did was to create this idea that drug users and crime were located in urban Black neighborhoods, right? That despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of drug users were white folks in places in like affluent areas like the suburbs, we came to understand sort of discursively that drug use and crime was concentrated in these urban neighborhoods. And so this idea of crime and drug use as being an urban problem, and that the drugs that were most dangerous and the biggest threat to America were drugs like crack cocaine, really helps frame drug use as an urban Black issue, right? And so what Rocky III does is that, it sets up who is our hero, who is our villain, in ways that speak directly to the politics of Reagan's war on drugs. So the villain, you know, Rocky's opponent in Rocky III is Clubber Lang, who's played by Mr. T. Clubber Lang is from the South Side of Chicago, and he very much embodies this idea of this sort of urbanized Black masculinity that was very much positioned as the sort of threat to broader society and to white America in particular. And you would see this sort of play out eventually when you have things like the Willie Horton ad in sort of George H.W. Bush's campaign in 1988. But Mr. T then sort of embodies this myth of this kind of urban black male threat to the fabric of America. And the representation of Mr. T really then draws on a much longer history of sort of the threatening black man, and specifically the threat that black masculinity in film poses to white femininity. So there's a scene in Rocky III where Clubber Lang makes an explicit sort of sexual reference to Rocky's wife. And that's sort of this idea of black male threat to white femininity, this sort of sexual threat, is very deeply rooted in Hollywood and American culture. And so what you have then in Rocky III is Rocky battling the threat of urban black America. And what also happens in Rocky III is that you have Rocky and Apollo Creed unite in their sort of attempt to defeat Mr. T. So you have this allegiance created between white folks and the black middle class in that film, or affluent black folks or elite black folks, against this idea of the threat of urban black America. And what I think is really also, I mean, I make a big deal about this in the book because I think it's a big deal, is before Rocky's final fight with Mr. T in that film, Apollo Creed gives Rocky the American flag trunks that he wore in the first Rocky film. So it is, I think that it speaks to this larger metaphor of parts of America uniting to defeat this racialized threat during Reagan's war on drugs in ways that sort of overlap with the politics of Reagan's war on drugs in really important ways. I also think Rocky III really shows, you know, because of the ways that I already mentioned about the ways in which Mr. T and his character Clubber Lang and Reagan's war on drugs really sort of tested the limits of colorblindness, that you see it sort of revealed that the kind of racialized subtext of colorblind ideology wasn't that far beneath the surface at all.
And going further, you explore also how the Reagan administration relies on this ideology of colorblindness to not only sort of, you know, mask their own sort of, you know, war on drugs and stuff like that, but to rewrite both the recent and, you know, further back history, but really not that far back, of civil rights and abolition. And so what's going on there? And then how do you see that also being played out in Hollywood? What is Hollywood doing to also play on this, you know, rewriting of history?
Yeah. So I think your question speaks to this idea that I think is one of the most fundamental pieces of my argument in the book. And that is that historical memory was one of the most important pieces of creating the popularity or hegemony of colorblind ideology. And I think the best way to understand that with Reagan is to look at the Martin Luther King holiday. So Reagan signs the Martin Luther King holiday bill in November of 1983. However, Reagan had spent his political career as a fierce opponent of civil rights. He opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He opposed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. When he ran for governor of California in 1966, he promised to protect the rights of white homeowners to discriminate in who they sold their houses to or rented their houses to. He, in his gubernatorial campaign in California, referred to black neighborhoods as jungles. And as I mentioned earlier, as he gets into the White House, he does so on a campaign promising to eliminate affirmative action and school integration orders. We talked in your previous question about the war on drugs. So he had a very, very rigorous and exhaustive anti-civil rights agenda and a long history of opposition to civil rights. And because of that, he did not have any support among civil rights groups or civil rights leaders in the early 1980s. And as Reagan is really ramping up his assault on civil rights in the early years of his presidency, he's getting more and more criticism from racial justice advocates about just how vehemently he opposes racial equality. So Reagan and his administration is sort of has their back against the walls where they or the wall where they want to pursue this anti-civil rights agenda, but they also recognize that they're taking a lot of heat for those positions. So Reagan's decision to sign the Martin Luther King holiday in 1983 was really for two reasons. The first of which was to try to placate opponents of his civil rights position. And the reason we know this is that Reagan had opposed both Martin Luther King and the idea of a Martin Luther King federal holiday bill up until the moment he signed the bill itself. So what you have then is Reagan saying explicitly in years like 1981 and 1982, he will not support or enact a Martin Luther King federal holiday. A month before he would eventually sign the bill, he spoke out against the holiday itself. And yet you have in November of 1983, him suddenly shift and sign this bill. And so on the one hand, this bill allowed Reagan to sort of placate civil rights activists and civil rights proponents, including Coretta Scott King, the widow of Martin Luther King, who, when Ronald Reagan ran for president in 1980, Coretta Scott King said that if Ronald Reagan was elected president, it would mark a resurgence of both the KKK and the Nazi Party, right? So Coretta Scott King was very explicit in her beliefs about Reagan's racial views. So on the one hand, Reagan signing the federal holiday bill helps to address some of that criticism, right? And to signal, hey, I'm not an opponent of civil rights. I'll support a Martin Luther King federal holiday. But more importantly, for the purposes of the ideology of colorblindness, by Reagan signing the federal Martin Luther King holiday bill, it allows him to henceforth position himself as a supporter of civil rights. And what he would increasingly do, he would position himself as the inheritor of Martin Luther King's supposed colorblind dream. So that in the aftermath of that bill, anytime Ronald Reagan was publicly criticized about his position on civil rights, he would offer some version of a quote he gave in 1986, where he says, "We want what I think Martin Luther King asked for, a colorblind society." Right. And even when he then dedicates a statue of Martin Luther King in the Capitol Rotunda in 1985, he starts to say, my administration believes in what Martin Luther King believed in, a colorblind society. And so what you see then is that Reagan's revision or Reagan's sort of reshaping of King and the civil rights movement in popular memory or in historical memory takes shape around exclusively this idea that what informed the civil rights movement was what was at the center of the civil rights movement was a sort of ideological commitment to colorblindness. And of course, that isn't the case at all. But that becomes the sole representation of Martin Luther King and the sole representation of the civil rights movement that the Reagan administration offers on this national discursive level throughout the second half or so of his presidency. And so throughout his second term, as he's continuing his assault on these civil rights programs, he always goes to the reason why I'm doing this is not because I oppose civil rights. It's actually because I support civil rights. I support and believe in the idea of a colorblind society. And that became so popular that at one point, a New York Times writer referred to Reagan's referencing of colorblindness in King as the Reagan race phonograph, right? So it's this idea that it was a broken record that he played so often. And so Reagan was very effective at sort of reshaping public memory of the civil rights movement around colorblindness in order to attack civil rights. What happens then is as Reagan leaves office at the end of 1988, Hollywood picks up that project of imagining civil rights and imagining Black freedom struggles more broadly as being driven by this steadfast commitment and ethos of colorblindness. So what you get at the end of the 1980s into the 1990s are movies like The Long Walk Home. The Long Walk Home is a film that's released in 1990 that is a fictionalized portrayal of the Montgomery bus boycott. Of course, the Montgomery bus boycott was started by Rosa Parks' refusal to yield her seat to a white passenger. in Montgomery, Alabama in December of 1955. And that started the 13-month boycott of public transit in Montgomery, Alabama, in order to integrate public transportation system and help sort of dismantle Jim Crow in that city. So you have this very sort of important civil rights episode as, you know, as sort of fodder for a Hollywood movie. But in that film, which stars Sissy Spacek and Whoopi Goldberg, what ends up happening is that Sissy Spacek is a middle-class white woman. Whoopi Goldberg works as a domestic worker in her home. And over the course of the film, Sissy Spacek begins driving in carpools, shuttling black workers to and from their jobs in white neighborhoods. And of course, we know from the history of the Montgomery bus boycott that carpools were one of the many ways that black folks were able to continue to go to work, to and from work every day during the boycott, right? So if they couldn't use the buses, Montgomery bus boycott leaders created this elaborate carpool system where you could find rides to and from work. And so in the film, one of the central sort of things that happens in the film is that Sissy Spacek starts driving in these carpools. She's participating in the Montgomery bus boycott by driving black folks to and from their jobs. Rosa Parks attended the premiere of that movie and said afterwards to a reporter that asked her what she thought of the film. She said, "You know, I don't recall any white women driving in the carpool." And so what you have then is this representation of a real moment in civil rights history. But what Hollywood does is that it inserts a colorblind white hero into that action in order to say not only was colorblindness central to the civil rights movement, but leadership and heroism of colorblind white folks and what makes white folks in films like The Long Walk Home or in Mississippi Burning, what makes white folks heroes in these films is their colorblindness. That idea was central to the victories of the civil rights movement. And Hollywood would expand this not just, would not limit this to the civil rights movement. They would expand it again to broader black freedom struggles. So you start to get movies also in 1989, you have Glory, right? Which is this representation of the Massachusetts 54th Regiment, a real all-black regiment in the Union Army during the Civil War that was led by a white colonel named Robert Gould Shaw. And yet what the film becomes about is the supposed colorblind heroism of Robert Gould Shaw, played by Matthew Broderick. And of course, we know from the historical record that colorblind heroism was not actually part of the history of Robert Gould Shaw, or was not Robert Gould Shaw's motivation in leading that regiment. So the issue becomes not just that these films are historically inaccurate, right? Because Hollywood movies like this, they're not actual true stories. They're based on a true story. The importance then becomes is what does Hollywood do with the wiggle room it creates with this based on a true story moniker or label? And what happens then is that in the 1980s and 1990s, Hollywood makes more and more of these movies about Black freedom struggles. Everything from Glory to The Long Walk Home, Mississippi Burning, Ghosts of Mississippi, Amistad, and so on and so forth, that insert fictional white heroes into the center of Black freedom struggles. And one of the reasons I think this is so important is that it shows this bipartisan participation in the ascent and influence and power of colorblindness. So Reagan uses colorblindness to advance and bolster his anti-civil rights agenda. Hollywood then picks up on that colorblind ideology and ethos and aesthetic in order to attract audiences in the 1980s and 1990s.
And I think one of the things that's so interesting about what you were just saying is, you know, not only is this sort of happening in a sort of coherent almost campaign between, you know, politics and Hollywood, but that, you know, sort of famous civil rights leaders like Rosa Parks are looking at this and saying, I don't know what this is about, but this is not how it actually happened.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is important for a number of reasons. One of them being is that there's a lot of discussion today about what people label white savior films, right? And we think of white savior films, and part of what I think is limiting about the sort of discourse and conversation around white savior films is that they're largely ahistorical, right? When in fact, what I'm trying to illuminate in this part of the book is that what we think of as white savior films, which typically, if we think more contemporarily of movies like The Help or of Green Book, is that white savior films are almost always historical dramas about Black freedom struggles. And that move, what you see in movies like The Help, what you see in movies like Green Book, that emerged at a very specific time in American history for very specific reasons. And it is this moment in the late 1980s. Movies like The Long Walk Home don't exist in the 1970s or the early 1980s. Movies about civil rights in the 1960s don't look like what they do at this moment. So these colorblind historical dramas emerge on the heels of the Reagan presidency, right? So as Reagan gives us this version again of a colorblind civil rights movement, a colorblind Black freedom struggle, Hollywood, you know, capitalizes on that immediately afterwards. So you have this protracted period beginning in the 1980s where popular memory is reshaped around this idea that what has solely sort of informed and driven Black freedom struggles has been colorblindness. But that is what these things have always been about. And colorblind white folks have always made heroic contributions to these efforts, right? So the point is not just that those things aren't true. The point is that that narrative was used in the 1980s and 1990s to advance political positions that undermined civil rights programs.
And so, speaking about, you know, sort of new genres of films, one of the things that you talk about towards the end of your book is, you know, this genre of teacher films that sort of emerges in force in the 90s. And so what are teacher films and what do they tell us about colorblindness in the 90s and how it sort of developed?
Yeah, so teacher films, you know, refer, you know, I'm using that to refer to a series of films in which what you typically have is a white woman a middle-class white woman who takes a job in an urban inner city neighborhood teaching as a teacher, teaching students that are predominantly Black or Latinx. And then what you have over the course of the film is these teachers sort of saving these students, getting them to buy into their education, getting them to leave their gangs, getting them to stop dealing drugs and to buy into their education as this sort of way out of the socioeconomic condition of the neighborhoods they find themselves in. And so, you know, and this plays very much on a couple of things. It plays on this sort of idea and discourse of the supposed cultural pathology of urban Black neighborhoods that you get through things like the Moynihan Report beginning in the 1960s, that, you know, you get through the 1980s with things like Reagan's War on Drugs. So it plays on that idea, but then it also builds on this idea of colorblind white heroes. And so what I think teacher films really mark is the culmination of nearly three decades of colorblind ideology. And so what you have by then is an entire genre of Hollywood films, right? So if historical dramas like The Long Walk Home or Glory are part of a genre, right, historical dramas that deal with a wide range of topics, they just do, you know, Glory and The Long Walk Home just do so by focusing on Black freedom struggles. Teacher films are an entire genre all in and of themselves. And my argument is that teacher films as a genre rely on colorblind white heroes, that is part of the expectations, that is part of the sort of rules of the genre itself. And so you have movies like Dangerous Minds, where Michelle Pfeiffer plays a teacher that moves into this inner city neighborhood to serve as a teacher and to get them to basically stop a lot of her students to sort of stop buying or stop selling drugs and value their education. So there's this big moment, kind of transitional moment or shifting moment in the film where she, as a way to teach these Black and Latinx students poetry, right, she shows them Bob Dylan's lyrics to Mr. Tambourine Man. And all the students sort of hate this film. They hate this these lyrics. They don't get it. They don't know what it's about. And then when Michelle Pfeiffer's character says, "This is about Bob Dylan writing about a drug dealer," suddenly all of the students are engaged and interested in poetry, right? And so it's this idea of edge of that. It's presenting this argument that in order for these urban racialized communities, Black communities in particular, in order for them to overcome the poverty that they face, right? These are movies that don't acknowledge systematic racism. They don't acknowledge decades and decades of white supremacy and decades and decades of discriminatory policies that have sort of mandated the impoverishment of their communities and then have then over-policed them. None of that is acknowledged in these films. It's strictly this idea that what holds these communities back, what explains their socioeconomic situation, is a lack of cultural value placed on education. And so what you have in these teacher films are typically white women coming in to teach these urban Black populations what they need to know to supposedly lift themselves out of poverty.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting is just, you know, how sort of pervasive that idea sort of becomes during the 90s and then sort of continues to be. Because I know for myself, Freedom Riders, the 2007 film came out when I was in middle school. And the amount of times that we were shown that film is just crazy, especially considering the school that I went to was majority, like, very much, you know, Black. I went to middle school in Roanoke, Virginia, which is a very segregated city. And at that time, the school lines had not been changed since desegregation. And basically what happened was the middle school that I went to, all of the sort of ghetto neighborhoods, low income neighborhoods, apartment complexes across the city were fed into that one middle school, no matter where you lived. And they showed us Freedom Riders so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Freedom Riders is another sort of iconic teacher film, right? And Freedom Riders, you know, I think that's teacher films and Freedom Riders in particular is another, is one of the films that I think really speaks to the title of the book, that this idea that Hollywood narratives about these racialized communities are really about recentering whiteness. Because a movie like Freedom Riders ultimately has very little to do with the actual experiences of or sort of systemic and structural racism that is impacting these communities. It just uses low-income, impoverished communities of color as a foil to reinforce and celebrate colorblind white heroism. And so, you know, again, that's the sort of that sort of centering whiteness, and in the case of teacher films, often sort of white femininity as sort of colorblind. So, you know, and I think the other thing that teacher films do is they implicitly sort of reinforce this idea that it is the quote unquote ghetto itself that fosters and sort of reproduces this culture of pathology, right? So what you have in just about every teacher film is that the teachers, the kind of colorblind white saviors in these films, they only teach in these neighborhoods for a single year, and then they have to leave, right? So Hilary Swank comes in for a single year. Michelle Pfeiffer comes in for a single year. And the idea, what's sort of meant by that, it's that if you stay too long, you'll catch the quote-unquote ghetto, right? And then you'll sort of lose all of the sort of educational value that you've brought into this community, right? It'll sort of suck the life out of you. And the way that you see that in a film like Freedom Riders is that there's an important scene in which Hilary Swank's character is in the faculty room and she has lunch with one of her white male colleagues. And the white male colleague basically says, and I'm curious if you remember this scene, he basically says, don't waste your time with these students. Like, they're never going to learn anything, you know, like just cash your check and move on with your day. And it's this idea that is a white teacher that is taught at this school for a number of years. He's caught the quote unquote ghetto. He's caught the quote unquote cultural pathology, the lack of value of education that is sort of bred and reproduced in these neighborhoods. And he then is incapable of the sort of savior role that Hilary Swank will perform, because she sort of parachutes into this neighborhood, saves a few, you know, one class of students, and then gets out of there.
Yeah, I definitely remember that scene. You know, for me, like, is along with, you know, just how this is sort of, you know, illustrating the history of colorblindness. And, you know, we still very much have teacher films and they very much affect, you know, society. And for me, I also, when reading this, I was thinking about, because when I initially entered college, I wanted to be a high school teacher. And that was what I sort of initially wanted to do. And because I was sort of on, you know, the listservs for all of that, I very quickly started getting bombarded by emails from Teach for America, which, you know, is sort of, at least in my mind, it's sort of an outgrowth of this kind of colorblind ideology and sort of teacher film ideology in terms of how it sort of presents itself. And then, you know, I would see so many people, because of my school, at Virginia Tech, a lot of people who were going into education just happened to be history majors.
Yeah.
And so a lot of them sort of had this ideology of, OK, I'm going to go for Teach for America for, as you were talking about, this temporary amount of time.
Yeah.
And they almost always put you in sort of a low income majority minority school system. Yep. And then they pull you right back out after you've gotten sort of your cultural experience.
Right. And the way, my understanding is that one of the primary ways that Teach for America attracts candidates is by saying, this is a great way to go to an elite law school or an elite MBA program, right? Come do your 2 years for Teach for America, and then you can get into Harvard Law School, right? So the idea then is that you're not actually invested in a longer educational project in these communities. It's again, it's that idea that you can parachute in, make some immediate impact, and then leave to get on with your life. Yeah, and I think that you see that. And just to kind of go back a little bit, the important sort of social history of colorblindness that you see in the mid-90s alongside of the emergence of teacher films is you begin to have ballot initiatives in states like California that implement colorblindness as, you know, into law. So so in 1996, California passes Proposition 209, which was called the California Civil Rights Initiative on the ballot. And it used the idea of colorblindness to eliminate affirmative action in the state, right? So to me, that marks really the culmination or the sort of hegemonic moment of colorblindness, that over the course of 20 years, you go from having it as in sort of these pockets of suburban white opposition to, say, school integration or busing programs. And then it gets into the White House in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, where he's really advocating and using colorblindness to try to eliminate civil rights programs, and has sort of mixed results at the Supreme Court level throughout his presidency. But by the time you get into the 1990s, you then have a majority of California voters voting overwhelmingly to support a bill that uses colorblindness to eliminate one of the very victories of the civil rights movement. And then along the way, you think about Hollywood's role in that, right? From films like Rocky into these sort of historical dramas like Glory, into this sort of genre of teacher films in the mid-90s. And it's this idea that what these communities don't need is some unfair quote-unquote handout like affirmative action. They just need to learn to value their education in the way that Michelle Pfeiffer or eventually Hillary Swank is trying to teach them, and that will give them all of the opportunity they need and all of the opportunity they deserve to get into college, right? So to me, teacher films are not just important because they are sort of another iteration of the so-called white savior genre, but it is the white savior genre in terms of education, which is no accident that when thinking about education and educational opportunity, you're immediately thinking about things like affirmative action, right? So that overlap is very, very important.
And so before we let you go, you know, we have this great book in front of us. Once again, White Balance, How Hollywood Shaped Colorblind Ideology and Undermined Civil Rights. So we have this great book, and I encourage all of our listeners to become readers and go out and grab this book. It's great. I think it's really timely right now. But this book, you know, just came out last month. And so if you want to tell me you're taking a break, that's completely fine. But what might you be working on right now? What's your next sort of project?
Yeah, so there's really kind of two ideas or two projects that I plan and hope to tackle next. I think, you know, the timelines for them being somewhat different. But the first of which is a book-length project that I plan to co-author with one of my colleagues, Michael Cohen, that is much that effectively is a broader look at how Hollywood has shaped American racial ideology throughout the 20th century. So if you know, this book is really sort of a focused look at a 30-year period. The project we're imagining is looking much more at how Hollywood throughout its history is sort of has shaped American racial ideology. So we think about it as sort of a book about race in Hollywood and as a history of both through many important movies. One of the kind of more tongue-in-cheek ways that we've spoken about the project is to say, you know, that it's race in Hollywood from Birth of a Nation to Birth of a Nation, talking, you know, about D.W. Griffith's 1915 film and Nate Parker's 2016 film, right? That you have that's sort of the bookends. Although we probably won't talk about Nate Parker's film. The other project is really an outgrowth, very explicitly of this project, right? We talked a lot about these historical dramas that emerge in the late 80s and early 90s, these sort of colorblind dramas about Black freedom struggles. What I think is fascinating is that what you also have, and I don't get into this in the book, is that during that same period, a lot of Black independent filmmakers are making movies of their own that are historical dramas that offer very different representations of Black freedom struggles and offer and instead locate the agency and the heroism of those freedom struggles squarely in the hands of Black activists and Black folks. So there's everything from something like Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust to even something like Spike Lee's Malcolm X, right? Malcolm X by Spike Lee's 1993, right in the middle of all of these films. I don't think that's that's not an accident that you have, I think Spike Lee saying, okay, you want to talk about the 1960s, here's a movie about Malcolm X. And so I do want to, you know, I have plans to do a project that's more about this idea of historical memory and Black independent film. So those are kind of the two ideas. You know, it's easy to have ideas, but as this project taught me, it's an uphill climb to get them out in the world.
Well, those sound very much interesting, and I'm sure this might be very corny, but for the second project focusing on Black actors and Black films and everything, perhaps you could call it Black Balance. Sounds extremely corny, but I feel if it was myself, I couldn't pass up the opportunity. Yeah. But in any case, I'm sure when those eventually come out, we'll have you right back onto the program. But in any case, thank you very much for coming today.
I would love to be back, and thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.